ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Page 19.5, summary in four parts of the philosophical significance of the King's questions, as gleaned from the Bhaktivedanta purports of this chapter. 1. When a pure devotee is dying, he fixes his mind on Krishna with determination. His only desire is to return to the spiritual world. From Maharaj Parikha's personal example, we see that such a devotee should prepare himself by retiring from family life. He should shift himself to the bank of a sacred river. Even prior to this, one should rectify any offenses he may have committed. This will help the mind be fixed upon the lotus feet of the Lord without any deviation. To that end, one should ask everyone to accept his obeisances and beg them to excuse all his offenses. One should consult with authorities about how he should spend his final days. Sages usually avoid the association of those who take part in the material world. But in the case of a pure devotee who is about to die, they must overlook his previous material situation. They should give him their association. As for the devotee, he should consider his situation thusly. Quote, "The Lord, as a special favor to me, is personally removing me from this material situation, for I am so strongly attached to it." By thinking this way and surrounding himself with the Lord's devotees, he feels himself surrendered to the will of the Supreme Lord, and thus he conquers his fear of death. In this way, even a devotee who had the most perfect life in the material world obtains the most favorable conditions for going back to Godhead at the time of death. All obstacles are removed from his path. The devotee's position is so secure that even the demigods work to help the devotee at the time of death, at the time of the death of his body. Verses 1-7. So this preparation means that you're winding up the material attachment. The fear of death means fear that we don't know where we're going, where we're headed. So that fear then generates an unwillingness to necessarily go there and a tendency to take shelter of something here in the material sphere. So to avoid that, then the devotee then purifies himself by, if there's anything, any offenses that may have been committed or any ill will, he tries to correct all that by forgiveness, by obeisances, by, you know, nice dealings. He removes himself from the situation that will generate that material desire, and situates himself where he'll have good association. You know, it's, yeah. And like that, and he sees that this whole process then is the Lord's mercy, because we are very attached, so then at some point the Lord starts to take away. Now here he's giving, the point is the devotee's, what is it? In this way, even a devotee who had the most perfect life in the material world obtains the most favorable conditions for going back to Godhead at the time of death. Hari means one who takes away. So with the same ability that he can take away, he can give. So the two go together, right? The two sides of the same coin. We see it's very common. Someone who's had that full life is also very able to give it up. But we notice it's those who've had a full life in a pious way, right? Those who are very concerned about gaining material facility and happiness, but not necessarily in a proper way. If you think about it, you don't hear about them graciously giving up and saying, yes, I've had a good life, so now it's time to go and leave it all. Right? But we do have instances where those who were very well situated, had so much facility, had so much, you know, material prosperity and position and enjoyment that they are able to graciously leave it all, right? But if we notice, that is people who are generally known as good people, right? Pious, nice, you know, they have some character, isn't it? You think about it, and all the themes of the stories and anything, anywhere. So that's the point, is the devotee, because he deals with the material world as the Lord enjoins, therefore he gains from it whatever maximum could be gained that the Lord, you know, feels is appropriate. Right? And at the same time, when the Lord starts to make it obvious that everything is kind of like going away, then he is able to accept that, because he has always been following the Lord's path. Does that make sense? So, means one may say, oh, it's such a difference. How could you go from having everything to having nothing? But actually, that's not the point, right? That's the duality. But the common point is, how do you say? That he was doing everything according to the Lord's desire. Right? Does that make sense? Now, why would... Now, these two thoughts could come up, right? Very plausible. Right? Either that it's, you know, observing the difference between the material life and the renounced life. Or the one seeing the commonality between both is being engaged in the Lord's service. Now, the first one does not create, security, right? But the second one does. No? Yes? No? Or hasn't caught on? This is an important thing. If you're thinking about, you're contemplating, oh, he had so much and everything, and he had so, and now everything's been taken away, he has nothing, that'll be so difficult, I have to give up all this, wouldn't that be a little bit more, it would generate some fear or some apprehension? No? Yeah. Okay. Then, but if we actually can think about it, you know, and appreciate that, actually, he's just absorbed in the Lord's service, and so for that service, Krishna at some point gave him so much, but now Krishna is giving him the opportunity to not having material attachments and have nothing, and this way be able to remember him. Is that not more comforting? You know, and gives it one more of a sense of security? Yes? Okay. Now, let us look at this. The psychology of this, of these two, even just psychologically. The one we're seeing the duality, of course. I mean, one way of looking at it is you're seeing the duality, so then that's material. The other, you're seeing the connection to Krishna, so it's spiritual. So that's the actual main point. So that's the spiritual versus material. But on the metaphysical, what's in between, because the one is easy to see, the other is easy to see, but still we're fearful, right? That's why the metaphysical is given, so you understand the connection between the two. So now in the metaphysical platform, the intelligence does two things. Or let's go back one thing. Intelligence discerns between things, but there's no emotion involved, right? Or let's say less emotion is involved, right? The consideration is not the emotion, okay? That makes sense. So that could create a sense of insecurity, right? Does that make sense? Because you're only analyzing, and the emotion's not being there. Technically, you're not connected with it. You're just analyzing it, right? It's cut and dry, and there's five pillars on this side. So, yeah, okay. You know, but, oh, you know, we have these pillars here, they're holding up the roof, everything, you know, then it's like, you know, there's more of a security. Oh, five pillars, you know. So in other words, once you put some emotion into it, there's some connection with yourself, then it's nice. But it's just five pillars, so what? You know, there's 10 leaves over there, there's about a billion rocks here, and, you know, and does that make sense? So, in other words, we're distinguishing between the platform of intelligence and platform of mind. Mind is the emotions. Mind is the values. So, in here, then, even in the intelligence, there's two parts, right? You analyze things in the way that you break them apart. You see the differences. And the other is you see the commonality, right? So the differences means you're taking the intellectual platform most intellectually, and the platform where you're seeing the commonality, it's actually bringing it closer to the mind's position, right? Because when there's commonality, that's when there's relationship, there's interaction, there's emotions, there's security, there all these different things, right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? Like that. You get that? Okay. So, now, if we look at this then, when we say, oh, it's the, means, you know, so much facility and position and now it's all taken away, what is, which aspect of the intelligence is that? Right? That's seeing the difference. So, it means it's like intelligence with intelligence. You know, I'm saying you're taking the intelligence divided into intelligence, mind. Right? Right? Because first you have to identify something. Once you've identified it, then you can see if there's something common between you. Right? But if you can't see it, how will you tell if there's something? If you can't identify that that's my friend, right? There's just a crowd there. So it's just, it's nothing there. But then you go, oh, that's my friend. Then you can think of the relationship. Isn't it? So first you have to be able to identify, then you can create commonality. So commonality is where you establish relationship. Right? So then, in this, then we're seeing the difference, so we're not connecting ourselves to it. It has nothing to do with us. Oh, they're so renounced, but before they had so much opulence, I could never do that. You know what I'm saying? And if we say, well, you have to do that because the time of death is going to be taken away, so you might as well get used to that, it only creates fear because I haven't connected it to myself. Right? And it's not working on the platform of samas or togetherness, right? Where relationship is on vyapti, which is separation. Right? So, but when you say that the Lord he's following the path of the Lord, and so in that path, then as a grihasta he had so much facility, but now as a vanaprastha he has no facility. But in any case, the common point is pleasing the Lord and following the Lord's path. That's the samas, right? So that's more pleasant and acceptable to the mind, right? Because it's the next stage, right? Because actually, what we're trying to do is develop attachment, not intellectualism. But it's attachment to Krishna, not Maya. So to detach yourself from Maya, we use the intelligence to separate between spiritual and material so we can see the difference, and therefore it becomes unattractive. You know, does that make sense? When you split something up, it becomes unattractive. Right? Isn't it? You go to the market, you see a nice big cauliflower. You look at it, goes, oh, that looks nice. But when you go into the kitchen, you see the cauliflower already cut up into little pieces sitting on a plate. It doesn't have the same, oh, you say, oh, you're cooking. You don't think, oh, something I want to eat. You understand? You know? You take your computer, you know, it's sitting there all nice and shiny and all that. Looks good. Hey, I like that computer. You ever walk in when a nerd's working on it? And it's spread all over the floor? Right? It doesn't look attractive. Right? Does that make sense? So, that's the whole point. This is what goes on. Only these things are going on. The whole thing that you are experiencing is one of four, or combination of any of these four. You're seeing the difference between things. You're seeing the commonality between things. You're deciding whether those things that are separated or common you like or don't like. what goes on in your head, all the discussions, all the feelings, that are nothing more than these four. Because that's all the intelligence and mind can do. Of course, you can throw in the false ego, that the prestige about it, but then still the mind has to accept that or reject it. Okay, so let's throw in the prestige element. And then the mind either thinks prestige is important and accepts, or rejects it, or within prestige decides that what the intelligence defines, that I can relate to that. Does that make sense? So that is the whole point, is that we have to make sure that whatever we're doing is that we're bringing it down to something that we can relate to, but keeping its connection to Krishna. That's why principle is so important, because principle is constant, right? I'm analyzing something, but I see the difference is it does not give peace, right? But if I analyze it, see the commonality, it does, right? So now details are differences, but principles are the commonality, right? Does that make sense? So you see why it's so important to establish principles, right? And these principles are eternal and always applicable, right? The principles of Krishna consciousness function any time, place, and circumstance. There's nothing that falls out of its purview, right? Does that make sense? One could try to argue that, but we're discussing Bhagavatam, so you might as well not, right? In other words, Bhagavatam is for those who have accepted that this is true. Those who still have doubts about it, that's Bhagavad Gita. Like that. Does that make sense? Bhagavad Gita is for removing doubts and misgivings. Bhagavatam is for those who have already accepted that the path of Krishna consciousness is the path. Now it's just a matter of connecting my conditioned nature to Krishna completely, so that it doesn't actually make any problem for me. Right? By habit, I still have some fears, some this and that, but the principle I accept. But detail, I don't quite understand. I don't know how to establish in my life Krishna consciousness 24/7. So Bhagavatam is telling us that. Right? Gita is telling us the technique. Right? So it is also trying to do that, but it has the added element that it's already dealing with people who are not convinced. Does that make sense? So that's the difference between them. Same topic, just slightly different angle. Like that. Okay, does that make sense? So, in other words, in one's own contemplation, then one will see differences, which is the first thing you'll see. Right? Then, so that's fine. In other words, there's no problem in this. But, if you want to apply it, then you have to be able to bring it back to the principle, and then get your mind to accept that. Right? In other words, if you've accepted the Krishna consciousness principles, then when you see a detail is connected to that principle, the mind will accept it. Right? Just like I would see before, talking about in the ancient days, you know. The devotees had accepted that whatever Prabhupada said, that was gospel. That was the way it was. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You could question to understand it deeper, how to apply it, but nobody took the position that it could be wrong. That's why I mentioned it's back in ancient days, you know, of yore. Back at the time when faith was still, you know, was still popular. So, you'd see two devotees arguing over a point. I mean, really seriously arguing. And then the third devotee would come in and say, no, but Prabhupada says here, this. That argument was ended that moment. There was no further, you know, last point to be made or, you know, ego thing or any doubt. It was gone. It just evaporated because the principle of what Prabhupada said is correct was accepted. And as soon as anything was shown that it was connected to what Prabhupada said, the mind accepted. If it couldn't see the connection, yes, there would be doubts, arguments, anything. Does that make sense? That's why it's all another reason we could say it's important to understand the principles of Krishna consciousness and that the mind has accepted these principles. Right? Because then when we, in our day-to-day life, as we try to apply Krishna consciousness, we may see a difference, we may see a duality. Then, when we can actually connect that duality back to a principle of underlying principle of Krishna consciousness, because every duality has an underlying principle that brings it together, right? That's a chintabhedabheda tattva. You have two opposing things, but they're perfectly combined in Krishna. Right? So as soon as you bring Krishna into it, there is the principle that holds those two seemingly opposing points, those details, apart. But Krishna brings them together. So then when you can see that, then you'll accept it. But if you haven't accepted the principle, still you won't. Because bottom line is, if your mind doesn't accept it, it doesn't go anywhere. Right? So, yes. You could, fault finding could be there, depends. There generally is, it depends. No. Let us say fault finding wouldn't be that. Because otherwise, why would you find such a taste in doing it? There's some strong underlining emotion there that you're finding a fault. Either it is a justice issue or it's a moral issue. If you think about it, I've been wronged, or someone that's important to me has been wronged, you know, or some cultural or philosophical point has been wronged, and so therefore very strongly find fault in the person. Or it's a moral issue that, you know, my standard of morality is higher than theirs, and when I find the difference between it, where they're on a lower standard than me, then I point it out because I think I'm a very moral person. Does that make sense? So the emotion is involved there. Otherwise, why is it so popular? How you can do it day after day, hour after hour, you know? Because of that, right? Or it can be, it would be a branch of the moral issue is, I don't do those things, but it's stuff I'd really love to do, but because I've accepted this path where I don't do those things, therefore I'm not doing those things, therefore if I hear about someone else doing those things, I want to hear every last little single detail of what they did, of the things I'd like to do but I'm not doing, so that I could actually get the taste and all that of something coming close to just playing with it, flirting with those things that I would like to do but I'm not doing because I'm very moral. Yes? No? Does it make sense? Yeah. So, that's the point, is that that's why fault find, there's a difference. This would maybe answer the question. Today's what?
Tuesday.
So, I don't know. Kontiya Prabhu asked about, he was trying to find the line between fault finding and discussing a fault. So discussing a fault means it's been pushed purely into the intellectual point. But it's made practical to those who are the audience that is hearing it, so it must make sense to their values and everything. But you're simply analyzing that this is a mistake and you're giving an example of it. But you have to take an example from somewhere. Examples are done by people, so therefore that will be used. But you're not finding fault in the individual, you're pointing out the fault in the action itself, or in the consciousness, or, you know, in other words, something in the sambandha abhideya and prayojana is wrong. And therefore, you will get a bad result. Right? Does that make sense? So that's allowed, right? But one should avoid trying to find the fault in the person themselves, right? Unless they are, you are in some way responsible for them. Then you can bring it to that personal. You know, the you can give examples of someone else, that would be kept intellectual, but when you bring it back to the person, then it can be more specific. Does that make sense? Or more directed, depending upon how close the relationship is, or how much, you know, what is the nature of their ego, and their how many issues they have. You know, so how delicate it is that you deal with these things, how deep they are. So, I mean, so, you know, you have to judge that. So a good teacher is able to find that path, and they're able to help whoever they're dealing with. You know, and if it doesn't work, then you have to figure out, is there a difference in nature here, so it's not a good, you know, teacher-student relationship, or is it that I didn't use the proper educational method, right? So it's just a matter of, if it's something you have to take responsibility for, then that's, you find a way to make it work. Or if you want to take, you know, you're in the position to take responsibility, you can try to take the full responsibility to make it work, and therefore kickstart the other person wanting to learn. Does that make sense? You know, normal thing is you make the endeavor of getting in the car and turning, bringing the key and putting it in and turning it and pushing on the gas. And the car is supposed to respond by starting. Right? Does that make sense? But if you get in the car and do all those things, it doesn't start, then you can get out of the car and push it. You know? And then it's supposed to start. But if after pushing it and pushing it, it doesn't start, then it's left. Does that make sense? So in other words, there's even a natural amount where the responsibility fully falls on one party. But in doing that, it's supposed to invoke action from the other party. If it does, then you have a working relationship. If it doesn't, then it's not a strong relationship. Does that make sense? Okay. So, is that understood in the difference between the two? Right? So that's, I mean, in other words, it may be sound fiddly, technical, or, you know, like that, but this is why we use these techniques, or these points, right? Because these metaphysical points can explain how something is technically working. So you can discern the difference and actually then come to find what's correct and what's not correct. Does that make sense? They seem to be fiddly points, but how much of the time there is something that we know is right but we can't do? Does that make sense? That's because we can't do it, because it's being separated from us by the intelligence. Right? We're not bringing it close enough that it's the mind can accommodate it. Does that make sense? So even we're not a good teacher with ourselves. Right? Because someone who's 11th canto, after giving the 22 gurus, then makes the point that someone who's very thoughtful, even from their own body, is able to be seen as guru. They can learn. Right? So we're not able to contemplate and get ourselves to understand, and we're not able to be good students for what is around us, our body, the other situations, this and that. Yes?
Before the analysis, don't we have to take into consideration perception, Maharaj?
Perception. Well, that was what we were meaning by the principle. The principle itself would be the perception, how we would enter into a situation, because this is a very important point, because every situation has unlimited ways you could look at it, right? You know, this is the thing that gets the quantum physics academics very enthusiastic, is the unlimited perceptions that are there. But they're happy to leave it at that. We know there's unlimited perceptions, so we agree with them on that point, because it is created by Krishna. And there's 8,400,000 species of life, so you could say at least there's that many perceptions. Right? So then, but then if we want to find truth, so it's true that there's that many perceptions, but out of those perceptions there is higher and lower. And out of those perceptions there is the supreme perception. Right? And out of the supreme perception there's perfect, more perfect, and most perfect perception. Right? And even within the most perfect perception, then you have, you know, five levels of perception. And of those five levels, then, you know, the gopis is the highest level of perception. Right? And then within that, then you have, you know, three main groups, so the middle group is the main one. Right? And within that, you understand, it just keeps going. So the whole point is that when the perception is connected to Krishna through the parampara, that's the proper platform. That principles, that's what we accept. Just like the Shastra gives so much detail. But how we're going to view that detail, you need guru. That's why it says guru, sadhu, and Shastra. Just picking up the books isn't enough. One has to have guru. Then guru gives what is the perception that we approach. How do we approach the scriptures? How do we deal with the scriptures? Then we look at everything from that platform. Does that make sense? So if we are grounded in the principles, you know, given to us by Srila Prabhupada, that were established by the previous acharyas headed by Srila Rupa Goswami, as given to them by Lord Chaitanya. Right? Then, whatever scripture you approach, one will not be bewildered. Does that make sense? It's like, devotees read the Mahabharata in the Bhagavatam, and there's never any question of any doubt about the devotional element in it, right? But when devotees read Mahabharata, sometimes that arises, right? Because it's taken for granted. Basically, it's taken for granted that devotional service is what you want to do, and now you want to see technically how it's applied in so many social situations. But because the volume of that is so great, the social situations seem basically overpower the devotional undercurrent. Right? Thus, most people, you know, make the mistake of what the Mahabharata's talking about. Is that making any sense? So that perception, those has to be seen, because even the, it's true, even the principles themselves are there, but they can be used in different ways. So the particular way we would use, in other words, a chinta beta beta tattva, how we would use those principles, that's important. Then within those, then that will necessarily bring up that certain details are more favorable and certain are less. Right? Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. That's the main principle. Right? Now, within always remember Krishna, but then now it's our perception on what does that mean, always remember Krishna. That means Krishna in Vrindavan. Right? And, but at the same time, we're in the material world, so we have Krishna who's not in Vrindavan here. Right? Krishna holding up this building by the potency of this pillar, that's not Krishna in Vrindavan. Right? Does that make sense? That's Sankarshan Krishna. Does that make sense? But we know by our perception that Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Prajumna, and Niruddha are expanded from Krishna. So it's just Krishna taking on different aspects to reciprocate with the devotees depending upon the way they surrender to him. Therefore, some surrender in awe and reverence, so he comes as Vishnu. some don't surrender to him, so he comes as the, you know, as the basically the universal form. Right? But he's still there. We still are taking shelter of these pillars, you know, that these will hold up our building. But we don't know that that is Krishna. So we're actually taking shelter of Krishna, because we are devotees of Krishna, but we don't know it. And Krishna is reciprocating with our surrender as manifesting as a nice, strong pillar. Right? So God's, his pastime of him and his devotees is going on. Just we don't see it. And because we don't see it, therefore we only see the pillar and everything external, so Krishna gives us the action and reaction to what's external. And you don't get the result of what's internal. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So then, when we are able to perceive Krishna in the pillar, then our having pillars is not a mundane thing. Then it's spiritualized. Right? It's not Braja Krishna, but it's spiritualized. So that means our material consciousness becomes dissolved. Does that make sense? But we're still dealing with it. This is the important point. We're not impersonalists. As soon as we see that, oh, it's Krishna in the pillar, so therefore we don't deal with it and we just go out and sit in the field where there's no pillars. No. If it's favorable or we're in that position, then we still deal with those pillars. But now we see those pillars. What is attractive about the pillar is its potency to hold the building up. Or we say, oh, it's a nice pillar. It's nice proportion or nice this and that, but that's Krishna's beauty, isn't it? There's a portion of Krishna's beauty in the pillar, therefore it looks nice. Right? There's a portion of Krishna's strength in it, therefore it holds us up. Right? But, you know, there's no renunciation, there's no knowledge, just, you know, these other things are not there. But those two are there. Does that make sense? So, by that, you're able to see that, this is what we were talking about before, see that in everything. Right? Means it works really well with the pillar. Next thing is apply this on your wife or son. It's the same thing. Right? You say something, they smile, you know, your heart melts, you feel, oh, so cute. But that potency is coming from Krishna. Otherwise, you have this 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair, sitting there somewhere in there, and it wants attention. But what is 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair, going to do? Right? Nothing. Right? You have this big, you know, nice, you know, what do you call it? How do you say? Lump of dead matter, for lack of a better thing, that Krishna's energies then empower, that then 1/10,000th the tip of a hair is able to get this big lump to smile. And when the smile comes, then the mother goes, oh, so cute. Right? Does that make sense? But the potency that's there, that's actually Krishna. That's why you have the song, Krishna Mata, Krishna Pita, Krishna Pranadan. What does that mean? Right? Because in the past time, he'll be my mother, he'll be my father, he'll be my lover, he'll be everything. Yes, you know. No. It means whatever it is in this material world that you think is of value, it's Krishna, it's nothing else. Otherwise, how can it? It's dead matter. Dead matter is not attractive to the soul. The soul has no interest in dead matter. So Krishna enters it. Therefore, it looks interesting. But because we're not Krishna conscious, we don't think it's Krishna. Right? And because you're having to accommodate material and spiritual at the same time and see them both at once, this metaphysical platform, though given, is not necessarily stressed. Right? Because it's easy to see spiritual, it's easy to see material, but to see them both simultaneously and work with them both simultaneously is more difficult. That's why this is given in the last six chapters of Gita, not in the first six. This is why it's given in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam and not before that. Does that make sense? But this is Naishkarmya. This is Buddhi Yoga. Does that make sense? The ability to accommodate material and spiritual at the same time, which is our nature. We are tathasta. Tathasta Shakti means the two are put together in the same place, same time. That the soul is in the body. That's the working of the tathasta Shakti. Otherwise, the soul has nothing to do with material. Right? Does that make sense? So, being able to function in that is not foreign to the soul, because that's what we're doing right now. It's just a matter of being aware of it. Is this okay? You know what I'm saying? In other words, you're trying to express this so that it's not a nice intellectual point. We're trying to express it so you can actually workably use this in your life. Right? And that means you'd have to want to use it. That means you'd have to be intellectually convinced and emotionally, you know, convinced. Does that make sense? Yes. How do we deal with things that don't have value for us? Then it's a matter of it belongs to Krishna anyway. It's still Krishna's potency. So we can't neglect it or deal with it badly because it's not ours. Right? Because actually what is of value to us or is ours is not actually ours. Right? Anything material, it's not ours, it's borrowed. You know, but it's given as our quota, because when you have a duty, along with the duty comes the facilities to perform the duty. Right? So then they go together. But we still have to remember that it belongs to God. Right? So that principle then goes throughout it. So since it belongs to God, though it's not our quota, it's someone else's quota. Or it's potential someone else's quota. So therefore, we're respectful of it, because it does have a nature itself. So the whole Varnashram is actually trying to teach us the principle of actual real Dharma. Real Dharma is everything has an inherent nature you can't change. It's God-given. So then it's a matter of recognizing that and seeing what is my relationship with that, and therefore interact with it accordingly. You know, interact could mean also not interacting. Right? It means I am taking up the position of a pujari right now. I'm going to go to the artik, and so there is some garbage here, and the garbage is inherently unclean. So therefore, my relationship with the garbage is to stay away from it. Right? And that's based on the principle that cleanliness is a major part of is the important element in the puja in this consideration, because Krishna is the supreme pure. So if you want to deal with the supreme pure, you have to be pure. And so to engage our conditioned nature in the Lord's service, therefore the Pancharatra has distinguished between impure and pure. Right? Because we're taking the conditioned platform to deal, therefore conditioning has duality, therefore then we apply the supreme pure onto what is closer to that supreme pureness and what is farther away from that supreme pureness. Right? Does that make sense? So that's technically what's going on there, and that's relationship. So that's means that would be the panchratic level, but that's what Varnashram deals with on the social level. The same thing, you know. On the Bhagavat level, it would be I am soul, Krishna is God, and I am his servant. Right? Therefore, he has his nature as the controller and the enjoyer, and I have my nature as his assistant, his servant, to engage my senses for the pleasure of his senses. Right? Does that make sense? So that's Bhagavat Dharma. Pancharatrik Dharma is the same thing, but accommodating the conditioned nature. And Varnashram Dharma is basically the emphasis is on the conditioned nature, but in a way that's progressive, that it can come, that it will bring you in the most quickest way, efficient way to the Bhagavad platform. And it's also very compatible with the Pancharatrik platform. because the Pancharatra is that much closer. The Pancharatra is Varnashram, that is only focused on the Lord. Right? And the full Varnashram is those accommodates those elements that aren't directly connected to the Lord, but are favorable, or at least neutral. But those things that are against, then, as we Madhuji pointed out before, those points our acharyas have said to stay away from. Even though they're within the Shastra, even though they're within the principle of remembering the Lord, but it's not how we want to remember the Lord, because we want to go to Vrindavan. So therefore, there are some things that we avoid. Does that make sense? Okay. But we know all that, so therefore it creates relationship. We're not doing this because it doesn't please Krishna. We're not doing this because the acharyas haven't given this to us. Does that make some sense? Like that. Okay, so a window of opportunity is opened here, then what we're talking about now, are there any questions on how to practically utilize that? Does it make sense? Is it seen the method that we're giving? That we're talking about? Not that we're giving it, but we're just talking about it. Yeah? Like that. So, even if it doesn't, if it makes sense, but it doesn't seem to be something that can be, practically utilized now, be favorable towards it, that if it does come up in the future, it's not something strange or weird. Right? In other words, this is the jnana yoga aspect of buddhi yoga. Yes, please.
You touched upon it last Sunday. You said this is very important. But perhaps you could elaborate more today. If we see relation of everything with Krishna, there's also the danger that we may just justify our attachment.
Yeah.
So could you elaborate on that?
Yes, a very important point that's there. Because then once we've accepted it, then means what I'm talking about, because it seems foreign, may seem foreign, then we're looking, coming in from philosophical. But once we've accepted it, the mind's accepted it, then the next stage one has to watch is then using it for one's own purposes. Is then justifying anything. So that also then you have to see is it according to Guru Sadhu and Shastra? What is the perception they give on it? Because there are other schools that will use it in a more mundane way. Like that. Does that make sense? Other schools of philosophy. Your tantras get right down. It means like there you have, you want to eat meat, so therefore you get a black goat, and on a dark moon night at midnight, like this and that, you have your mantras to chant and this and that, and then you can kill this goat. But so you could justify that these things are okay because it's according to Shastra, but it's not in our line. It's not used by us because they would, if someone is a meat eater, then they can start with that, and then from there then see that it's, if they can't actually use the process, then okay, let's say this. Even you're trying to justify the thing, okay. But in the justification, the tendency is to drop out of intelligence just into the mind, into acceptance. It's not a matter of intelligence means you discern between or find a commonality. But here we've already accepted the commonality, and now it's a matter of the mind accepting or rejecting, and so we're accepting. But in accepting, this is good, this is okay, we just have to watch that our arguments aren't purely mental. That they do have the intellectual element, that they are discerning and trying to develop and improve. But otherwise, because you either are moving forward or you're moving backwards. You can't stay in one place. The example is given is you throw a ball up in the air and it's either going up or it's going down. There's a moment just between, but it is a moment. Like that. So you can have a 1/11th of a second where you're not going forward or backwards, but then after that 1/11th of a second, then you're going one or the other ways. Does that make any sense? Is that too broad?
It's a very subtle.
Yeah, it's a very subtle point.
Subtle on our tendency to really justify something because everything can be rationalized. But no, I'm appreciating Krishna in it.
But then you have to be able to technically say why. If you're saying that, like I technically explained the pillar. So just saying it's there is not good enough. Oh, I'm being realistic. So, okay, great. What's real? In other words, you have to keep asking questions.
For instance, I may like rock and roll.
Okay.
I may rationalize that that's Krishna's energy because that's a sound, that energy, even the passion of it is Krishna's goodness. And somehow I like it too. I like to listen.
But how is that... How okay, so how is that Krishna?
How is not Krishna?
But you have to be able to explain how it is Krishna. We can say it's not Krishna because we know everything's Krishna, but you have to be able to say how it is Krishna. Just like I say, this is a 100-rupee note, and I would say, well, how do you know it's a 100-rupee note? Well, it's money. No, it's like it has a 1 and 2 zeros on it if it's 100, and if it has a 5 and 1 zero on it, then it's a 50. So you have to be able to explain, okay, well, the modes of nature are work. How is that? So that's the mode of passion. So how are you engaging that mode of passion? What is it doing? Okay, it's there, you've seen it's Krishna, but now how is that being connected to Krishna?
Well, say, it energizes me.
Okay, it energizes you, and energizes you for what?
For my service, perhaps.
So you're listening to the rock and roll while you're doing the service, or you're listening at home with your cargo jeans on and your t-shirt?
Say I'm listening while I'm doing my email.
Okay.
That gets me awake, it gets me focused.
Okay. So then, you know, you're finding something there that it's helping in some way. So... That's okay, that's good. Now, what happens when you get tired of that song or that genre? Then what?
I switch it off.
But then what are you going to do?
What
are you going to do for inspiration now?
It energizes me, and then when I'm energized, I'm okay.
Okay, no, that's your okay, but the problem is you can only listen to that song since it is a mundane song so many times. You know, so then you have to identify, because then you'll go to a different song or a different band or a different kind of music. So what is the energizing factor about it? Why is it energizing?
Because it's Krishna.
No, but how is it Krishna? What is Krishna about it?
Well, sound is Krishna's energy.
Sound is Krishna's energy, yes. But
and the art is some sort of Krishna's inspiration for the artists, the melody.
Okay, so now if we want to go down to the elements, okay, so we're dealing with Shankarshan of this. So you have the field, you have this music, and you have yourself, and you have these personalities who are, you know, making this music. So... But that potency that is there, it itself, what is its connection to Krishna? You know what I'm saying? It's not a song about Krishna, right? Well, then you're taking it is it you know the Hare Krishna rock and roll, or you're taking that it's not Hare Krishna rock and roll?
Could be Hare Krishna rock and roll, but. Even if it does not, Hare Krishna rock and roll, still, the principle remains.
No, it becomes a little bit closer. It doesn't have that chit potency in it. So then it will only be inspiring the modes of passion and ignorance. You want to say something on this?
Well, can't some music like that inspire you to think of Krishna? Like if there's a flute in it, for example, can't...
Yeah, but then you're connecting to flute. I'm saying there has to be some connection, that's all. You know, I mean, we're not, you know, it's not, I say, neural brain surgery here. You know, it's like, like that. You know, it's a matter of finding that connection. So if that's works for you, but then are you always appreciating Krishna in it like that? You know what I'm saying? When you're thinking, are you always appreciating the Krishna-ness of this rock music? You know what I'm saying? If it is, then yes. And then you'll find with time that it will be Krishna is more important, and then the medium of that particular kind of music may not be less important. You know, and then one would incline more towards something that's devotional. And then of that, then you know, it may stay at that and it might move on. You know what I'm saying? But it's not a matter of just I said and then it's done. It's a matter of what I'm talking about is you're able to perceive that all the time while you're listening. Does that make some sense? Because there's something in there that you like, you know, there's a part, oh hey, I like this part. But it's just, are you just liking that part? Or are you appreciating that potency of Krishna that is there in that music? There's a difference. Because the one is just the ears, the other one you're using the intelligence and the mind, you're using higher elements. You know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that you have to just be able to see that itself, that inspiration, is going back to Krishna. Because whatever it is Krishna. But you have to be conscious of it. When you are conscious of it, you get the benefit of that. When you're not conscious of it, you don't get the benefit of that. So this kind of music may be a little harder to engage in Krishna service. You know? The words are a bit, what did Prabhupada call it? They had a name for it. It's kind of like the mystical words and stuff like that. You know, it's just, you say it's more bewildering. It's nice poetry and stuff, but it's not like that. It's because what they're saying is just, you know, is off of their inspiration at some moment, but depending upon their inspiration, you know. And then, you know, sometimes what they're talking about, you know, may not be so great either. You know. You know what I'm saying? So, can be, you can say that, but you could technically, but then you'd also just on that have to technically, how is sound Krishna? You know? So if you can explain it, then fine. But then you should be able to maintain that platform of Krishna consciousness. That's why you choose those things that you can be Krishna conscious in. You know what I'm saying? So Krishna's pointing out is that it's like this, is that when one isn't so situated on that, there are certain things that it's much easier. It's much easier to listen to, you know, the songs of the acharyas like that, and be Krishna conscious, you know, then let's say Krishnaized rock and roll, right? And then regular rock and roll would be even harder to find. And so if you can find that in it all the time, you may or may not be so interested in it, because you would also notice, if you can perceive Krishna in the mood of it there, you can also separate off from that. This is another side we didn't discuss. But in perceiving the one, you can also perceive the other. It means when you can perceive the spiritual. When you can perceive the metaphysical, means you can see both the mundane and the spiritual. So then you also perceive the feelings and emotions of the persons who are making that music. You know what I'm saying? If you can catch what is the element that is Krishna in it, the live part, you can also see all the baggage that is around it that the musicians themselves are carrying. So if that nature is there, that conditioning is there, is strong, okay, that's there. But you keep seeing Krishna in it, after a while, what the musicians carry becomes less interesting. So one is not interested to associate with Krishna on that platform. But if the attachment is very strong there, fine. but it should be, it should be the endeavor is made to see Krishna's there, that we, that we've sat down and contemplated for, you know, 5 seconds and said Krishna's there, great, but what are you doing this second? You know what I'm saying? You know, it was great, okay, you know, 20 years ago, you know, you fasted very nicely on a codicil, and so now you're still trying to get something out of it. Oh yeah, you know, yeah, we stayed up all night and we fasted, and we, you know, and everyone, oh wow, it's such a great, you know, such a great sadhaka, like that. No, but that was 20 years ago. What are you doing today? Does that make any sense? In other words, you can use that if you want, if you can connect it, but then you have to always be using it. Because it's like chanting Hare Krishna, you're conscious of it or not, you still get a spiritual result. You're conscious, you get a better spiritual result. You're not conscious, you get a less spiritual result. You worship the deity, you're conscious, you get a better result. You're less conscious, you get less of a result. I mean, of course, we're leaving offenses aside. You're in the association of devotees, then you make advancement. You appreciate it, you make more advancement. But if you're listening to the rock and roll music, especially karmic rock and roll music, you see Krishna in it, then it is purifying your attachment to it. You don't see Krishna in it, you're becoming bound by it. That's why it's more dangerous. Does that make sense? You don't have the things that are established by the acharyas, then when you are conscious, I mean, it always works. You're safe. But if you are going to, you know, deal with the material energy, then as you're conscious, you get the benefit, and as you're not conscious, you get the reaction. So that's why you have to be very careful in doing that. It could be done. You know, theoretically it can be done. But one has to know what one's doing. You know, like that. And so generally, someone mature enough to do that would very quickly pass over that or not deal with it at all. You know what I'm saying? If you like the rock, so then you listen to devotional rock. You know, and if you want something even more hidden, that it sounds more devotional, but its underlying pinnings are still pop music, then you go for those who do that. You know, it's like you take like Aindra, is able to present traditional music with underlying elements of rock music that you wouldn't even know it's there. But he uses all the technique and everything of traditional music. You know. So it also gives more of a buoy. You know what I'm saying? So it's just you have these different going back and back and back elements. So you just choose what works. Buddhi yoga means you're intelligent and you're able to discern and see what works. So certain things are recommended because they always work. There's some peculiarity, you know, you like dried flowers in the corner of the stairwell on the quarter round table on the first landing, then do it. But you have to connect it to Krishna. Is that okay?
What is poison for one is can be nectar for
another. Yeah, of course.
But everything also, that there are many levels of people who have different kind of conditioned nature, and it's maybe good for, like Hare Krishna Maharaj used to say, that I made this music for karmis, not for my devotees. So devotees shouldn't listen. He used to say, should not listen it.
Yeah, that's right.
But you are saying that for karmis is great because it brings them closer, but for devotees, it just makes them bad.
It's just like you also have, depends on your mode. Is very, some of this very heavy, you know, contemporary music, it actually throws the life airs out of balance, the nature of it. But if you're so ignorant that nothing's happening at all, by the life airs being disturbed, it actually seemingly creates action, which is superior to inaction. Does that make sense? So that's what you'll find is the difference between feng shui and vastu. Because feng shui is working with real serious motive ignorance. So there's things in feng shui that you would do that in vastu you wouldn't. Because in vastu, it's a matter of channeling the good energy. But in feng shui, it's a matter of creating any energy. Because you're starting with a mode of ignorance, so you're trying to create action. So there's things that you would do that would create action that you wouldn't use in vastu. Right? So sometimes you have that. You know, just like when you have a curve on a road. The inside of the road will be less energy. The outside of the road will be high energy because whatever's going down that road is going into all the houses. Vastu won't allow that. Anything on that side of the road will be finished. But it's finished. Being finished means there's an action going on. Right? If it's just sitting there, it doesn't finish. It's only if there's an action to be finished. So from action, then you could go into something else. So it's recommended you're on that side of the road, not this side of the road. Does that make sense? So that also is an element there, is that we're taking, you know, good motive goodness, and goodness includes a touch of passion or ignorance. So therefore there's certain systems. But if the ignorance or passion is so great, then lower levels may be used. Because Prabhupada says you don't have to change your situation, you have to change your consciousness. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why it means it doesn't matter, you know, what you use. You start from there. That's what we mentioned before. You don't have to change it. That's your music. You listen to it. But start connecting to Krishna. Then it will be purified. But then you pick a situation for that. You like that kind of music, then you're not going to get that music here. You know, here you can use some headphones or some small speakers. But you won't get the full taste of, you know, 10,000 watts, you know, disturbing your life airs. If you do that, then other devotees will criticize and this and that. So socially you'll have some problems. So along with hearing the music you like, then you'll have all kinds of social difficulties. Plus you always have the thing of the difference between just the flavor of the Dham and this music. That you'll have that starkness. Like if you're in the West, you're in your house, you listen to this music, you walk out of the door, you know, inside your house, outside your house. I mean, it's not that much difference. It's your house is only how Krishna conscious you make it. But as soon as you step out your door, that's Maya's place. You know what I'm saying? But here in the Dham, you're in your house, you're out of your house, doesn't matter where you are, it's all Krishna. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, if that is, then you have to pick what's important for you. You know, you like that, then, you know, then be on the road with the band, then you'll get the full taste. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise, how much taste to get out of it in a pair of earphones? Something, but not. Does that make sense? So that's the point. That's why we're very broad-minded. We can accommodate that. We have no problem. But as one matures, one oneself wouldn't use that. But you have no problem if someone else uses it. Because if they use it right, it will have the same effect. Right? It'll dissolve one's attachment. How much that kind of music's going to inspire your attachment, that's another question. But at least it can be used to dissolve your attachment to it. Does that make sense? This one? Like that. Why don't we, okay, we'll officially stop and then if anyone wants to continue after. Okay, otherwise it's late. Jai Ho. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaur, Amen.